agenda. All right, we'll call this meeting to order. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Policy Committee meeting of Wednesday, March 19th, 2014. A quorum is present, and we will start at the top of the list, Senate File 2401. Senator Hoffman has a bill on muskies to present to us. What you're working on this year, muskies?
With scopes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I'll take that friendly amendment from right. Senator Osmick on the scopes with the muskies. So.
That was inside good. Joke to everyone observing is we've gotten a lot of emails about muskies, and Senator Hoffman's name seems to be attached to all those emails. So,
Mr. Senator Chair.
55-inch or 50-inch muskies, that's what we need to decide here.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 2401, known by many as the Eric Bill. With me today at the table is Beth Frazier, who is the Deputy Secretary of State. I'm just going to give a brief overview of the bill, Mr. Chair, and then Ms. Frazier will address the issues that are germane to this committee.
Yes, thank you, Senator Hoffman and members. Yeah, This has a slight nexus with this community committee in that it makes use of driver's license data, and that's what compels it to be in front of us. And so hopefully we can be brief with this. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We know in Minnesota we have a great voting system, but we also know that it can be improved and be made more efficient, saving us time and money. In order to increase both the efficiency and the integrity of the Minnesota elections, I'm carrying this bill that, when passed, would allow Minnesota to participate in a data-sharing program that is controlled and governed by those states that choose to participate in it. I'm just going to give a brief background. In 2012, a consortium of states consisting of both Democratic and Republican secretaries of state created the Electronic Registration Information Center, also known as ERIC. ERIC was created because states recognized that the data on America's voter rolls contained significant amounts of out-of-date and inaccurate information, and as a result of these issues, the states created ERIC with the sole mission of assisting and improving the integrity of the voter rolls and increasing access to voter registration. Because we live in a mobile society, we know it takes a concerted effort among those states to ensure our voter rolls are accurate. And using the ERIC Data Center allows Minnesota to safely and securely compare voter data against our own DVS data, the Social Security Death Index, and against other states' voter and DMV data. In addition to the laudable goals of ERIC, I'm going to give you some specifics to Minnesota. And currently, we cannot use the Social Security Index to identify deceased voters on our voter rolls because the Social Security Administration no longer provides last state of residence in the data. ERIC allows Minnesota to remove the deceased voters from the rolls. Having decreased voters appear on the rolls is not only inaccurate, but decreases voter confidence when they see that someone on the rolls as they know has passed. Currently, despite county officials' best efforts, Minnesota voter rolls do contain duplicates. ERIC would allow Minnesota to identify those duplicates and remove them from the list. Again, that's increasing accuracy and voter confidence. And then two more points. Currently, 70% of Minnesota who use the same-day registration at polls on Election Day use a current valid driver's license. ERIC would allow us to reduce this number by identifying voters that need to update their registration prior to Election Day. We know that same-day registration provides an important service, but it also increases the time spent by all voters at polls and the time spent by counties processing data after Election Day. And finally, many of Minnesota's otherwise eligible voters are not registered and wait until Election Day to register. ERIC allows us to identify these potential eligible voters and provide information to them on how to register. This bill would permit Minnesota to address all of those issues, and it would allow Minnesota to join both the conservative and liberal states that are already using the ERIC technology to ensure accuracy and integrity voter rolls and to provide outreach. With that, I will turn this over to Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Welcome, Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier, the Deputy Secretary of State. And the part of this bill that is most pertinent to the committee is obviously the first section allowing the driver and vehicle services to share information with our office and then giving us authority to pass it on to participate in the ERIC program. This is very similar to data that the Driver and Vehicle Services is already sharing with us since the Help America Vote Act passed and was implemented in the state in 2004. We have been verifying voter records with Driver and Vehicle Services, and there is a process for data sharing with them already. So I'm happy to go into more detail or to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Questions, members? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see anything in this bill regarding a purge date. We have had a history of having data residing in different departments that they're sharing information. Is there, is there any indication as far as how long the data will be held on to before it's purged?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's a really great question. The data before it's turned over to ERIC is anonymized, and so the data that they have is actually indecipherable. But there, I don't believe, is a purge date, and we would be happy to add one for the data that is shared with our office.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Osmond,
I would strongly suggest, I know the chair has certainly been interested in this, that we have data that resides in places that it shouldn't, and I would strongly recommend before this moves to the floor that you have some type of indication that the data has to be removed from the system. Is there anything, continuing on this, is there anything that compels registration in this bill, that if you find the person is not on the voter list when you do your matching, that it actually compels a registration to be inserted into the Secretary of State system?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, there is no automatic registration, and registration is not compelled. What this tool does is it provides a list of people who should be potentially removed from the system and provides a list of people who appear to be eligible but are not registered, and then states that participate are required to both clean up their list and reach out to those voters and invite them to register. But it does not register them without them affirmatively taking action to sign up.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when the data is doing the data match, what fields or what data elements are we matching upon to determine if the person exists in the city or no longer exists, that the person, you know, might have moved within the same city? What data fields are we doing the matching on?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, they're looking at a variety of different data fields. They're looking at name and name variations, date of birth, last four digits of the Social Security number, driver's license number, address information. And so they're looking at all of those different fields. And what they've found is that they're able to, between those different fields, match records that often would be passed over and that we're not currently able to match.
One final question, Mr.
Senator.
Chair. What levels of security is being performed on this or is being used on this data? Certainly data that has identifying features such as the last four digits of Social Security number can be considered somewhat protected. What level of access or what level of security do we have on this information?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, the data is run through an anonymizer before it leaves the state control. So the data that the data center actually looks at is completely anonymized, which is different than encrypted, as I understand it. So it can't be turned back into the actual number. But then they looked at the anonymized data and find matches with that.
Thank you. Senator Senjum and then Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe to the author, Senator Hoffman, has this one gone through judiciary?
Senator Senjum, that's where it goes next.
Okay. And so my question was basically, and I could be wrong, I'm just sort of thinking on the fly. Seems to me a driver's license, if I were to ask public safety for a copy of all the driver's license registrants in Minnesota, that's private data. But the question is, does it become public data when the Secretary of State owns that information?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, no, it doesn't. The Data Practices Act says that data has the same classification even if it's passed to another agency. So it would remain private data in our hands.
Just to follow up kind of for the fun of it, but voter registration lists are public, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sundrum, voter registration data is an odd set of data because it's technically not public, although it is widely available. But it's only available to people who are registered to vote in Minnesota who swear that they're going to use it for purposes related to elections, politics, or law enforcement.
Okay.
And then only certain fields of the data are available under those circumstances.
And I'll just add, I have a little familiarity with this driver's license data issue, should my bill pass. The agency that has primary control over the driver's license database would be required to enter into an agreement with any other agency that's gaining access to that data to make sure that they're adhering to standards for privacy and appropriate use, establishing procedures and monitoring procedures, et cetera, to accomplish those purposes. So remember that. You'll see that bill soon back on the floor. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier and Senator Hoffman, my question, I think, is somewhat similar to Senator Sundrum in that that was my impression. The only people primarily that want these names are folks that will pay you for those lists. And so why wouldn't we just let them worry about improving the list on their own? Say, for example, political parties spend a significant amount of money trying to improve the lists and make sure they're accurate. Why don't we just let them do it instead of the Secretary of State's office and the taxpayers pay for that?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Senator Fader. Peterson, I think there's potential. There's a potential for great cost savings, especially at the local level, by cleaning up the list ourselves. So as Senator Hoffman was saying, 70% of people who come in to do same-day registration on election day use as their proof of residence an updated driver's license. And if instead we knew who they were and were able to reach out to them and get them to update their registration or automatically update their registration ahead of time, we would significantly decrease the number of people doing same-day registration, which means there's potentially less need for to hire election judges in the polling place, less data entry after election day, which many counties hire temporary staff to come in and do, and cleaner lists ahead of time for those who are trying to reach out to voters and encourage them to participate. There also, as Senator Hoffman was saying, using this data provides the opportunity to purge the list of people who have died. Obviously, it's in everyone's interest to ensure that people who have died are no longer on the list, and as well as to realize that people have moved out of state or have moved within Minnesota.
Thank you. Okay. Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hoffman, have you had anybody contact your office that's opposed to this bill? Or?
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, personally, nobody has contacted my office opposed to this bill. The questions that you all raised here are questions that were raised in prior committee hearings, and especially the anonymizer, which takes the 18 alphanumeric sequenced numbers, and at the end of it, they were able to match up this state, this driver's license, and it's amazing to watch this thing work because it really does get to the heart of cleaning up those voter rolls.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Any other questions, members? Anything further, Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair and members, I would hope that we can move this Senate File 2401, and as Senator Sundrum, you validated it, it would move on to judiciary, so I right. would like
Thanks.
A motion from somebody.
All right. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 2401? No. All right. Does anyone like to move Senate File 2401? Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 2401 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
Members, we're going to take item number 6. At this point, Senate File 2660, Senator Sharon's bill on medical assistance, non-emergency medical transportation services. Next, only because everyone else who has a bill on the agenda is on this committee, and she needs to get on to another committee. So, and she apparently has worked out something, so it's going to take less time than we thought it might. So welcome, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I'm here to present 2660, Senate File 2660, which is a bill that is making changes to the process for non-emergency medical transportation. Just by for context, the Office of the Legislative Auditor did a review of our non-emergency medical transportation system and made a number of recommendations for change and improvement, including establishing a advisory committee that was to make a report in 2012 to the legislature about how to improve this system. Our committee has asked for and did receive an extra year to complete the work because creating a model of providing services of transportation throughout the state, recognizing, as you do in this committee, that there's variations of what kind of transportation capacities there are throughout the state, required us to spend time to really nurse this legislation into the form that you see it in front of you. So this bill has had a review in the in our Committee of Health and Human Services and Housing. So it is a bill primarily related to medical assistance and the rights of medical assistance clients to have transportation to their medical appointments. What our bill does is try to establish a way of assessing the level of need that a person has in terms of what kind of transportation best meets their needs, but is the most the cost effective as well for this for the program. And our committee has reviewed all of these policies and passed them, but we needed to come to you because a component of the bill requires the Minnesota Department of Transportation to play a role in carrying out some of the elements of the bill. So we're here to talk to you about those components today. And if that is, when I talked with Senator Dibble, I asked if that's where he wanted us to focus, and he said yes. So with that,
yes, I would very much like for you just to focus
just on to
that.
Stay focused there.
I appreciate reimbursement rates and the determination of need and all that stuff. That's not our bailiwick.
That's correct, and we will be looking at that and find other issues about that in finance. But we wanted you to know that we've worked through the issues related to the Department of Transportation and the role they play in relationship to vehicle inspections. And with that, if I may introduce Sue Abderholden, who chaired the committee. I just should tell you that this has been a real challenge, many, many different players at the table. It's a fragile agreement in the sense that people have, from every perspective, have had to let go of a little something in order to make this happen. So we are really very happy with the product and hope that you will be supportive today.
Great. Can hang on 1 second, Ms. Abderholden. I saw Senator Kiffmeyer's hand.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'd rather have the testifier.
Okay.
I can wait.
Great, thank you.
We do have an amendment to the bill that I should offer offer.
All right.
It is the A2 amendment.
All right.
Which speaks specifically to the subjects that are in front of this committee.
Not technically an author's amendment, because this is not the committee of origin. I'll take the pleasure of the committee. Would we like to hear the amendment before we vote on it, or would we like to just take the amendment now and put it in the shape that has been agreed to by the stakeholders?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the author's amendment.
All right. The pseudo-author's amendment. All right. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
Thank you. Ms. Abderholden will review the work that the committee did with the department to work out the description of the role that they will play in relationship to this bill.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and co-chair of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Committee. What we worked out with the Department of Transportation is that all of the providers now of NEMT have to actually be certified. And, you know, we have these vehicles who are transporting some of our most vulnerable children and adults with disabilities. We want to make sure that their vehicles meet certain standards and that their drivers do as well. Knowing that the department couldn't just do this starting July 1st, and frankly, we don't know how many new vehicles will need to be get certified, and actually our whole process is really taking 2 years to implement, we thought it made sense for any new provider who now would have to meet these new standards would actually request a waiver from the Department of Human Services so they could still get Medicaid dollars. And that would give the department a way to count how many vehicles are there that are now going to have to go through this new certification process. They would give that information to the Department of Transportation. We can come back next session and find out what should the fee be to cover the projected costs of certifying these new vehicles. And if we decide that there is need to maybe change the rule a little bit to accommodate these new vehicles, then we can they can ask for rulemaking authority at that time. So we thought this was actually a pretty good idea for since none of us, it would be a wild guess to know how many vehicles would come through here. So this would, again, give a variance for basically about 18 months and give us time to plan.
Thank you. Questions, members? All right, I see Mr. Rudine hovering. He's pointing to someone, so whomever from the Department of Transportation, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Rhodes, staff attorney in MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Among other things, we work with limousine operators, motor carriers of passengers, and special transportation service providers to help improve the safety of their operations. We do this by implementing, administering, and enforcing Minnesota statutes and rules. I'm here not today in opposition of this proposal, but instead to ensure that there are not any unintended consequences to MnDOT's STS program and to let the author, Ms. Abderholden, and the legislature know that MnDOT is interested in working on language to create a program that MnDOT can successfully implement. I'd like to thank Ms. Abderholden and Ms. Berezovsky's efforts today for working on this amendment and just to say that we are committed to continuing to work on this.
Thank you. Does this amendment create enough of a pause so that MnDOT can get a handle on the scope and scale of the new certification program that you have to undertake so you can get your arms around it and bring a proposal back next year?
Mr. Chairman, we believe so. What we need in terms of you know, time, and then what Ms. Abderholden and Senator Sharon have said, that we could only make wild guesses about the number of providers and vehicles that might be part of this program. And so what we need, you know, is time, but also those numbers, because based on those numbers, we'll be able to decide how many employees we may need to hire, and then to figure out the total cost of what it would be to administer the program. And based on that, we would, you know, hope to come up with the fee that we would charge the providers to recoup the cost associated with administering the program.
Thank you. Questions, members? All right. Thank you. Anything further, Senator Sharon?
No, thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 2660? No.
Great.
Oh, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sharon, I just have a question. Since this is somewhat a response to the legislative auditor, the things that are in this bill today, the change in the bill, are they fully implementing what the legislative auditor recommended?
Senator Sharon.
You know, the language in the bill does not speak to every element of the legislative auditor, so you don't see the language, but we have as a part of this a policy bill that that implements the reforms that were recommended by the legislative auditor that are guiding the decision-making process and changes to that, a process for how changes can be made to that so that stakeholders have input into it. There are other issues that we may at some time need to come forward with. There's improvements in terms of protections for fraud in this bill, but there may need to be more reform in that area. And we also have had some conversations about, because this only deals with the fee-for-service side of our non-emergency medical transportation program. There are other PMAP programs or managed care programs that do address non-emergency transportation. This bill does not relate to that, but we may have to take a look at what's happening in that area as well. But for the auditor's report, which was looking specifically at the fee-for-service component, this does speak to everything that's in there. It just that I believe that there are some things that we yet may be able to do in relationship to, because of the documenting that we'll do to improve reduce the incidence of fraud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Sharon, that's very good to hear, because I know the legislative auditor on our behalf does a lot of good work, and so we always want to make sure that what he does do, we follow up, or it's just kind of an exercise of futility, and that's not what it's about. So I'm glad to hear that, and I think, too, with the Minnesota Department of Transportation having an opportunity, we'll obviously see a little bit more on this as well. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Anything further, members? All right. Do I have a motion? Senator Jensen. Senator Jensen moves Senate File 2660 as amended to be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. Any further? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed no. Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Sharon. All right. Will we revert to the order of the agenda?
Yes.
Item number two, Senator Reiner. 2706, towing orders. All right, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have Senate File 2706 to speak to it. I am going to ask Rob Layton to talk about the details.
Welcome, former House Member Layton.
Okay, but not a House member now, Mr. Chair, so he doesn't violate our House members.
I know, testify. I know. I wouldn't let him at the table if he did.
Lobbyists are fine. House members, yeah. On the other hand.
Yeah, that happened once. I once sat at the table and got in a ton of trouble when I was a House member over here at the Senate. And then it happened a couple years ago, and so we started referring to the House members, Mr. instead of Representative. You're Mr. Layton today, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for agreeing to hear this bill today. I really appreciate that. I'll try to be very brief. Again, my name is Rob Layton. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Towing Association with an issue that just recently came to our attention. We don't believe this bill is controversial in any way. The bill simply brings the current towing statute up to date with what we believe are the current practices in the towing industry, and that's the intent of this bill. I should start by saying that oftentimes issues are involved. One group that has an interest in these on behalf of consumers is legal aid. And the first thing I did when we drafted this bill is I went to Ron Elwood for legal aid, told him why we needed this bill. Legal aid, Mr. Elwood, are completely fine with it. They recognize this is non-controversial, and they have no objection at all to this bill. The current, just to briefly state what the current statute says with regard to a towing authority may not tow a motor vehicle from public property unless a peace officer has prepared a written towing report that describes the motor vehicle and the reasons for the tow, and that towing report must be signed by the officer and the tow driver. And the statute does not otherwise define a towing report. And here's the problem. The problem is that the current statute references this need for a towing report that's signed by both law enforcement and the towing company. But, in fact, in this age of computers and the Internet and emails, oftentimes what happens is that law enforcement, be it a peace officer, a fire department, there might be a snow emergency, will contact a towing company either they might do it over the telephone or they might do it simply through email and say that we need this car to be towed. And so the towing company will then arrive and they'll tow the car. The problem is there is no towing report in those situations, and there's no report that's being signed by the towing company or by law enforcement. So that's why there's a need for this bill. This simple change simply reflects what's happening the current practices. And so Senator Reinhart did say that he thought it was important that there be a paper trail of sorts with regard to this. And so the language in the bill simply states that after this request has been made, whether it's through email or verbally through a telephone call, that after the car has been towed or at some point there would be written confirmation that the tow was made and the reason. But that could be done simply by having the towing company send an email to law enforcement saying, we received your order, we've towed the car, it's been completed. So there would be a paper trail of it, but at least then technically the statute's going to fit with the way it works in the real world. So that's the intent of this bill.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Reinhart, on the surface, when I first read this bill, it seems like it's a pretty broad expansion of that authority. I'm trying to think, in, like in St. Cloud, for example, we have a stormwater management staff person that's a city employee. Does that person qualify as a state or local authority? So a stormwater management or a parks and recreation employee of the city of St. Cloud can tow a vehicle?
Well,
Mr. Late.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, our intent was simply to make clear that regardless of which public official was requesting the tow, that the standard would be that there didn't have to be any sort of towing report signed by the parties, but that there be a written paper trail afterwards. That's what we're trying to do, regardless of who's actually requesting that the tow be made.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, Senator Ryan. I'm open to suggestions from you, Senator, or the council. As Mr. Layton indicated earlier, the reality is, and most of us know our departments well, I know in Duluth we don't have a snow emergency ordinance, which is a whole other topic, sore spot for me. But so what happens is the fire department, when it needs to get to a home, ends up authorizing the tow, and technically that's illegal by state statute. So I'm open to language that would capture authorized agents, which might be police, it might be fire, it might be parking enforcement, and the city is large enough to have it. But I'd hate for us to be back revisiting this because we didn't accurately describe that. And I see Ms. Berzovsky, working feverishly as she always does to right. maybe help us with
some. I think she's trying to figure out what a state or local authority is.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to be able to order tows of cars. So.
Well, that was my Mr. Chair. That was my concern. I mean, there's a lot of people I know I'd like to have their cars towed. Quite frankly, I don't have a problem with the fire department officer, and I would even add first responder. So if it would be peace officer, parking enforcement, fire department officer, first responder, all are certainly appropriate staff, in my view, to be able to tow a vehicle. But
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Layden.
When we spoke to the revisor's office, I mean, are you concerned about the licenses or other state or local authority?
No. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That simply came up at the suggestion of the revisor's office saying that we don't want to miss somebody. We didn't mean to have an all-inclusive or exhaustive list, and it was the revisor's suggestion that we do that in case we would have been missing the public agency that sometimes will request a tow. So that was the intent of it, but I'm certainly fine with any suggested changes.
Mr. Chair, and I don't mean to bog us down on this bill, but I think Senator Peterson has a good concern, and if I were sitting at that table and he were up here, the suggestion I might offer would be to somehow clarify that authorization comes from a local governing body or a body with jurisdiction. So, a city council or county board could say it's police, it's fire, it's first responder, because those things, what they have in St. Cloud is different from what we have in Duluth. Then instead of us trying to capture it completely, maybe Ms. Berzovsky can give us some language that would say, our local electeds who are closest to it can authorize. So maybe a fire department officer, peace officer, or other local authority as authorized by the appropriate local jurisdiction, local governing body. Which I would consider a friendly amendment to my own bill.
So Ms. Berezovsky does have thought. There is some language, members, in the existing towing authority section of statute that we can probably reflect in this new language. So she'll be ready with that momentarily. If you can hold for a moment. She feverishly...
Mr. Chair, we could tell running stories.
All right.
Race results. Or
I'm running head to coast in August.
Do you have openings on your team, Mr. Chair?
Actually, one.
We'll after doing the Florida Keys, I would do hood to coast.
All right. Just the tour of the country. I'm doing also doing San Francisco to Calistoga. So we're just having a little visit here.
Never mind us.
Okay. All right. Are we ready?
Yes.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, my suggestion takes language out of, it's part of the definition of towing authority already in statute, and that it, so it would say on 1.11, after a fire department officer, it, I think we would delete then or another state, and the it would say, or any local authority authorized by Section 169.04 to enforce the traffic laws.
We would, Ms. Berezovsky, wouldn't we also delete or, wouldn't we delete the entire phrase or another state or local authority and insert your language?
Well, we could, or else we could retain local authority because that's part of the definition. It would read, or any local authority authorized by Section 169.04 to
right.
enforce the traffic laws.
All right.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
So who, under Chapter 169.04, who does that actually authorize in terms of, is it law enforcement then?
I'm sorry, I distracted her from your question. Can you repeat your question to Ms. Berezovsky?
Yep. The question was just in that statute 169.04, who does that actually authorize? Is it law enforcement or the parking?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, it would be up to the local authority to decide who is authorized. What 169.04 deals specifically with local authority to enforce. For example, parking ordinances and processions, assemblages, and so on, the kinds of traffic matters that are in local hands. So it would be whoever the local unit authorizes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That sounds great, you know, from my perspective.
I'm sorry. I think we need to deal with this language in the second spot.
I hate to say it.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest...
Yes.
On 1.14 to just eliminate, delete, or state.
Strong.
All right. Does everyone understand the amendments? All right. All in favor of the Peterson amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Any further questions on Senate File 2706, members? Anything further, Senator Reinert? All right. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Senator Reinert, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, are you wanting to lay this over, or?
We can move it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I would move that the Senate Transportation Committee recommend File 2706 for passage and send it to the Senate floor for full Senate consideration.
All right.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. All in favor of the Reinert motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator
Thank you.
Reinert and Mr. Layton. All right, so
there you go.
All
Good afternoon, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm bringing to you Senate File 2290, which is brought to me by the railroad workers in Minnesota. This is something that refers to railroad safety and inspection. There are rail yards all over the state where switching and inspection and billing of trains are occurring that don't have lighting. These functions are performed oftentimes just in the dark with small lanterns. The more I've heard about this, the more I think that something needs to be done to make sure that our railroad cars are inspected, especially tank cars. And it appears legislation is necessary to ensure that inspections are done at the best of circumstances. I'm pleased to represent this issue to improve rail safety and public safety, security, and ask for your support. Senate File 2290 seeks to assure railroad workers have lighting out in their rail yards to improve safety and quality of mechanical inspection of rail cars before they travel in trains throughout the state. I have two amendments that I need to move. The first will be the A1 amendment. And what it does is it deletes a section of the bill that I didn't think was totally necessary to be in this bill. Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Carlson moves the A1 amendment to 2290. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also move the A14 amendment. This deletes some references to the Attorney General, and it really is unnecessary for the bill, and it may lead to some misinterpretation and some conflict of interest. So I move Madam Chair, I move the A14 amendment.
Okay. We are having those distributed, I think. Senator Carlson moves the A14 amendment to Senate File 2290. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This legislation sets forth that railroad yards with lighting currently are grandfathered as compliant on the day of enactment. Railroad carriers have until November 1st, 2016 to bring all yards into state law compliance. What 2290 does is it proposes to mandate and set a standard for the lighting in Class 1 and Class 2 railroad yards. I have with me, advocating for the bill, Mr. Phil Qualley, State Legislative Director for the United Transportation Union and the Railroad Workers in Minnesota.
Mr. Qualley, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. Good afternoon. I am Philip Qualley, State Director of the United Transportation Union, representing the safety interests of 1,400 railroad conductors, switch foremen, yard masters, and remote control locomotive engineers in Minnesota. We have three testifiers today with us, Ms. Jennifer Schaubach of the AFL-CIO, Mr. Randy Raskin of UTU Local 650, as well as Mr. Brown of the BLE. But before they testify, I'd like to proceed, if I may. We will have a PowerPoint images of some railroad equipment in lit and dark yards momentarily, but I will just quickly walk through the bill and some points to the bill. I would like to respectfully remind you that we have a UTU committee handout with statistics and with two letters from Iowa and North Dakota regarding two tragic deaths that occurred in 2012 in dark and underlit yards. To the bill. Senate File 2290 proposes to mandate and set a standard for lighting in Class 1 and 2 rail yards. This legislation applies to system yards where locomotives are switched or inspected at least 5 times 5 days per week. Our language is specific and we believe well-crafted. Senate File 2290 excludes private industry tracts and is not federally preempted. In summary of the bill, again, we grandfather in the yards that have lighting on the day of enactment. And this is a significant concession for the railroad workers right out of the gates. Secondly, yards will comply with the American Railway and Engineering Manufacturing Association standards with at least one light for 2 yard switches. All lighting is to be focused on the track area, and so essentially this is a dark sky provision. And I remind the committee respectfully that most of our yards are in the heart of industrial areas or far out in the country. Our language has basic maintenance requirement and a waiver from compliance for the carrier during periods of severe weather, maintenance, or derailment. Also, our bill is crafted from the language construction of the Minnesota Walkway Law in 2008 and has a waiver from compliance process for the carriers to apply if they cannot reasonably put lighting in a yard. The bill also has the ability for the MnDOT commissioner to order more lighting in a yard if the parties see or the commissioner sees that it is necessary. But a party cannot come to the commissioner and ask for more lighting in a rail yard until they have gone to the carrier first and tried to work through a carrier process. Again, I would like to bring forward then why is this legislation necessary? If you would be so happy to hit that, please. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. First is worker safety. While we are enjoying very good and record low injury statistics, injury and wear and tear on the human body is real. As a member of the UTU, I sit on the National Switching Operation Fatality Analysis Team. There are 12 of us who are from labor and industry and the Federal Railroad Administration. And our statistics on safety are very, very good. But we are concerned that we are on potential for a curve in an upward swing with a demographic of employees who are staying on for longer periods of time into their third, fourth, and sixth years in the career. Secondly, I'd like to direct your attention respectfully to the handout letters regarding the last 2 fatalities that occurred in the upper Midwest and dark yards. After the CP fatality at Kenmar Yard, the Canadian Pacific came in and put in more lights in the yard. I would submit that the cost of one injury pays for the lights in a railroad yard. I'd also like to mention that Minnesota has 53 railroad yards where cars are switched or inspected 5 days a week. 27 yards have lighting. What we are seeing and what brings us forward is that we are seeing an increase in traffic, particularly with minerals and sand, and where more switching and inspecting of cars, blocking of trains, are being done at intermediate yards daily and overnight. So the second reason we request your support for this bill is public safety. We are performing air brake and mechanical inspections on rail cars in the dark with a lantern. FRA derailment statistics for year 2013 show a 24% increase over 2012, including an 11% mechanical equipment increase over 2012. From FRA reports for Minnesota, we had over $630,000 worth of damage from mechanical defect derailments, in 2013. I'd like to amend my comments. That is for year 2013 are those statistics, Madam Chair. I apologize. So going forward, regarding public safety and the importance of mechanical inspection of equipment, I'd like to please direct your attention to the handout that you have regarding Federal Regulation 49 CFR 215, the Appendix D mechanical inspection. Every time we place a railroad car in a train, we have to perform a federal inspection under Appendix D. It is a 14-point mechanical inspection on both sides of the car. The federal regulation is further silent on the quality of the inspection, only that the inspection has to occur. I'd like to please, if you would, take a look at the videos. We'd like to show you 5 images of what railroad yards look like when you're inspecting in the light, in the dark, again in the light and dark. We hope we can help you understand what we're saying. Go ahead, please. We have some pictures here. If we click right through, this is a lit yard. These are lit yards that would be grandfathered in. And here's a lot car where we see a 14-point inspection has to be done on the standing or moving rail cars. And I remind you that these are under a production schedule. We have to make our trains' departure schedules on time. And I'm very concerned that despite our members' best efforts, the inspections are not being done in an adequate manner to inspect the public. Pictures of a dark yard once again. In contrast, once again, please. And then finally, we have a yard that is from the is a fouled yard, and you'll see piles of rotting grain, sand, silica, and meal. This photograph was taken from the Union Pacific property prior to a Minnesota MnDOT walkway complaint and obstruction complaint being written. However, the carrier did get it fixed once and cleaned up once they knew that they had received a letter from MnDOT. We simply want to refer to the Minnesota walkway law that sets precedent for us in a moment. If you could please go to the video. See that is an oil train being inspected with yard lights. The next video. So I would just like to mention that this brings us to the question of federal preemption, and I would like to submit to the committee that Senate File 2290 is not federally preempted. I challenge any party that would assert federal preemption for railroad redlining to bring forward that regulation. There again, two other states have lighting regulations, and in 1977 there's a memorandum of agreement that was issued between the FRA and OSHA giving jurisdiction of yards areas to the FRA. Another reason we would like you to support House File 2290 is the carrier denial in an action following years of using requests for lighting. Our requests have come from safety committees. They have come from one-on-one conversations with management. Our requests have come formally from our state committee office, and I would like to direct your attention to a packet collection of letters in your packet of BNSF, where we went out in 2006 and 2007 and clearly said that at Dayton Bluff Yard, we had a last yard that departs trains towards Chicago and trains that travel along the Mississippi River. It was a concerted effort from the members on the BNSF property to get lighting. And you'll see there was a process that was gone through. The safety committee went out. We wrote letters of concern. And finally, at the end of the day, there was no lighting at it. And we still do not have lighting in that yard. That's a real concern for us. We've also had issues of maintenance with BNSF where a tower was, a derailment occurred. The tower was hit and torn down. Years later, that lighting tower has never been replaced. So I won't go on with that other than to mention that with Union Pacific Railroad, there's other letters in your packet that have largely gone with minimal response, and we are departing trains out of the Minnesota River Valley where a great deal of slowing is occurring, and we're again inspecting them in the dark, as well as Flint Hills Refinery from the General Railroad Yard. The
you know, Carrier said, well, the ambient light of the refinery is all you need. Well, that's not acceptable to us. We're taking 80 to 90, perhaps 110 gases of material size down in Riverdale from Rosemount to St. Paul nightly. And despite our members' best effort, we cannot assure you that these cars are being well inspected. By just having yard light, we can see the end of the yard loop tracks, and it gives us a contrast down to the areas where we walk and hang air and are in between the cars, securing the cars, that will really improve safety, but also inspections. So the final area is in regard to the question, how does Minnesota have jurisdiction? Where is the state's presence to assure worker safety and public security? Again, the state cannot regulate track structure or roadbed drainage. However, with a guiding precedent, I would like to read to you from the Minnesota Walkway Law Statute 2008 and our State Railroad Close Clearance Statute 1945, where Minnesota set a requirement that obstruction on track, slipping, crushing hazard be removed to assure safety. In this instance, Senators and Madam Chair, we request that the Railroad Lighting Bill sets a requirement that obstruction on track, once again, darkness and visibility hazard on track be removed to assure safety. So, finally, I would simply close in that we are not federally preempted, and, 2014, I think it's time to bring railroad yards up into the century. Building trade construction workers that work at night, power plant construction workers, they have a way in their dark work in place. We would respectfully ask the state of Minnesota to provide it for us. Railroads are earning record profits. We are earning record profits. We want to see our railroad companies do well. We think that this bill is necessary, and we thank you very much for hearing your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Senator Cross.
We have another testifier, Brother Raskin.
Madam Chair, members. I believe Mr. Qualley has pretty well encompassed the need for my first time. I'm a little nervous. Randy Raskin, local chairman, United Transportation Union. I represent approximately 130 members throughout the south and central part of the state.
Welcome,
road
Mr.
conductors. I'll try to get over my nervousness here. I believe Mr. Qualley has covered this rather well, but I'd like to make a few points that in regards to the rail yard at Flint Hills behind the refinery. The Carrier had done a large expansion, and they promised us lighting from the very beginning. We're 6 years on here, no lighting. This yard in particular has no ambient light. It's down behind the refinery, behind the forest. It is virtually working in a black hole in all reality. We have several other locations that my members, my brothers and sisters work at that are like that. Miriam being one of them with the large influx of sand production and mining, as well as when we're out here, these railroad workers, my brothers and sisters, are doing the best they can with what they have. They're using a railroad lantern. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're meeting the federal requirements and regulations. But this lighting at these locations where switching is done would greatly enhance that for the inspections, as well as the working conditions overall. So I'd be willing to answer any questions if anybody had about the working conditions or what these what our brothers and sisters are doing out there. But I believe Mr. Qualley has covered it rather well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Raskin.
We also have Jennifer Schaubach from the AFL-CIO, please, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Ms. Schaubach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I am honored and proud to be here with our UTU brothers and sisters in support of Senate File 2290. Workers' lives have been saved, and injury and fatality rates have dropped in many industry sectors of the economy. However, too many employers continue to cut corners, putting workers in serious danger and costing lives. Many hazards remain unregulated. It's our job to continue to fight for safe jobs. Railroad work is strenuous. That's a hard word to say some days. It involves 24-hour outdoor work all year. The real world industry has a long history of hard work, long hours, and strict timelines, as Phil mentioned earlier. Railroad workers' injuries and fatalities have dropped over time, but they still occur at higher rates than many other industries. Track work and rail work are the most dangerous in the industry with the highest fatality rates. Workers can get struck by trains when working on active tracks, and crushed injuries are hazards during coupling, switching, operating doors and hatches, and loading cars. First and foremost, workers' safety and health is a priority of the American labor movement. When railroads are reporting record profits, one in particular reported that their profits more than quintupled, mostly due to job cuts and the closing of rail yards. But there then should be no excuse for neglecting the safety of railroad workers. Establishing railroad yard lighting standards here in our state does no harm, but it would save lives. One worker's death or severe injury is one too many. We stand proudly with our union brothers and sisters working on the railroads in support of Senate File 2290 and strongly encourage its passage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Schaubach. Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, I'd stand for questions.
Members?
Chair.
Senator Tomasano?
Madam Chair. Senator Carlson, remind me why we took out Made in Minnesota Solar.
That's a mandate that I don't support, where we're limiting the number of companies that can supply that product. I have a solar manufacturer that's in my district that so happens to not be certified as Made in Minnesota.
Why don't they get certified?
Pardon me?
Why don't they get certified?
It's a long conversation, but it starts with the abilities that were granted the other two companies, special treatment so that they could get UL certified. And then the next stage was to limit it only to UL certified companies.
So it's got nothing to do with having to go to commerce after this, right? If it stayed in.
Senator Carlson.
I'm not sure. Did I state that? I didn't state that.
No, just a rumor I heard.
Oh. No, I think I don't know if it has. Does it have to go to commerce? I'm not even sure where it's going after this. Madam Chair, is it?
Finance next, and then.
Yeah, it's going to finance.
Okay. Finance next, and then environment and energy?
No.
No, okay.
No.
Yeah.
Does it stop at commerce?
No.
Yeah.
Sorry. Members, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Qualley, I noticed in the bill here, in Senator Carlson, you're given about a little more than. I guess it's 24 months, a little more than that, starting July 1st, in order to, I'm just trying to get a sense of, have you guys looked at kind of the math on that in terms of how many poles have to be put up in the yards that you'd like to see improved, and how many poles that is a month that have to be installed and that type of thing? I'm guessing, the railroads are going to have their own staff do this. And, from your perspective, is that an achievable goal?
Senator Carlson or Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, we do believe it is an achievable goal. We want to let you know that, many of the big mother yards, as we call them, the primary yards, are lit and are grandfathered in. So what we're looking at are yards with anywhere from 3 to 9 or 10 tracks. And if, depending on the number of poles, absolutely, yes, this gives them ample time to review that and put together their engineering specs and to get the job done. And we would welcome them doing it sooner, because we have clearly expressed urgency for public safety, yet we've crafted a bill where we've given them a considerable amount of time. So, yes, thank you for your question, and, yes, they can achieve this.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, we all care about our safety and workers and the whole system that goes on. Question I have for you is, you're grandfathering in or deeming them compliant. Could you tell me more about those yards that would be deemed compliant and the status of their lighting? Because I'm concerned you're going to deem them compliant. starting from that date, that goes on quite a while. So how are they compliant? How do they match up with what's in your proposed bill here?
Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for your question. Have the balance of the non-27 yard lights, which is roughly, 21 or 30, whatever the number is. And we are in those lights. The lighting is, for the most part, pretty good. So the commissioner will deem them compliant, not the UTU. If the commissioner should see a yard that is not sufficient, there would be the ability for the commissioner to order more lighting. But we're trying to strike a medium ground and set a standard that the commissioner can enforce that is reasonable. I would say that at this time, 4 out of the 5 railroad yards, on average, when I look at the carriers across the state, pretty good lighting, pretty good lighting. Our guys can get the job done, and I think that's reflective in our records. So we're willing to take that and make that concession to get this bill passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just a little follow-up. I think in here it says deemed compliant, so there is no discretion of anybody when it says deemed compliant. It's a fait accompli in regards to this language. However, so that's about 80% are already, according to your testimony here, sufficient lighting, and I commend the railroad and others and all everybody for their work on that, that you've reached that 80%. That's very good to hear. And so on the other 20%, is there any specifics as to, if I ask somebody from BNSF or Pacific or so on as to why not the other 20%? Because it seems like if they've done well on 80%, begs the question, what's holding up the other 20? Is there some sort of reason or purpose for that that you can think of?
Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, committee members, as railroad workers, all we can do is run the trains and make the requests. The railroad managements make those decisions, and the requests have been in for a long time, and we don't have lighting in that balance of yards. And my math escapes me, but we're talking about roughly 20 yards. And the key here is that more switching is going on there now. A great deal more switching is going on out in the intermediate yards. I would compare what we're seeing on the Minnesota right-of-ways from our members' reports, heavier than we've seen. And the traffic is very heavy, and as a 34-year veteran railroad conductor, I will tell you this mirrors the grain sales of the 1970 to 1981 Russian grain deals that we used to see our yards all over the state. So, again, we are back to a maximum capacity, and we have every reason to believe the railroads in Minnesota are going to continue at maximum capacity. So that's that percentage of yards we need the lighting in. I hope I've answered your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that has addressed it somewhat. I guess I put you in a difficult spot asking you to speak for somebody else as to why that might be the case, but I appreciate your comment. I would say the increased use exactly is an important thing, but I would be looking for, I appreciate the information from your members, but also usually just a few more cold statistics, you might say, that just demonstrate it. But even still, to commend both management and the employees as well, because I see this chart going down on incidents, while at the same time, if we put another chart next to it, you've had more activity. So the fact that it can go down and at the same time use go up is something to be very proud of, and it's a very good track record, and hopefully maybe this will encourage it along as well. Thank you.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. Senator Carlson, sorry. You and Hoffman seem to blend together. Sorry. On this bill, how many of the current dark yards or what volume of dark yards are currently abutting residential areas? I don't see a lot of description in here and any measurements on the amount of lumens that will be allowed to stray off of the existing property. Are there a lot of dark yards that are going to suddenly become lit within residential areas?
Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, committee members, I would say no. The American Railway Engineering Manufacturing Association, which is a railroad policy document of hundreds of pages governing different areas of the construction of railroads in the mechanical and engineering area, has prescribed luminans of what railroad yards should have. I apologize that they are not in your packet today, although I think I have visited many of you and left that information prior to this hearing today. However, that said, we do have the bill requirement that lighting be focused down on the track, which we see as a dark sky requirement. And finally, a lot of our yards are out in industrial areas and at the center of industrial areas. So I don't see this near neighborhoods. Another piece is we will see rail yards out in the middle of the country. You don't even know we're there. We've got yards that consist of 2-3 tracks that are classification tracks where, again, blocks of cars are being set out and then put back into train where Appendix D mechanical inspections are required. So without going too far afield, I do not see an impact on the residential neighborhoods.
Madam Chair, want to follow
Senator Osmond.
On another topic, I have a question on this. It seems like this is going to be illuminating these yards from dusk until dawn. I assume that their lights will not be on during daylight hours. Is there any thought to provisions that would allow for the lights to be able to be triggered based upon activity within the yard and save energy costs for the yards themselves, or is that something that's not a consideration?
Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, committee members, we think that's a fine recommendation, but I think that gets into a discussion that's beyond the scope of the bill, although I think when the Commissioner of MnDOT has this process that all parties can come to, that's certainly a consideration that could be taken into place.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee and Senator Osmek, I think a couple of things you mentioned, the lighting of residential areas. As Mr. Qualley says, that the lighting is for inspection. So the tendency is to have it focused downward on the tracks, on the parts that are going to be inspected. It's not really to light up the area for getting around, for movement. And also on your mention of the hours, I would say, first of all, that is up to the owner of the yard. But I think our problem here has been that, and this, I'm sorry, Ms., Senator Kiffmeyer's gone now, but that there's been more activity, and it has moved from daylight into evening, into night. So some of these yards perhaps could have handled some of the traffic in the past in the daylight or in the evening. There's a lot of switching that goes on at night, and so the more switching and the more building of trains has to go on, the later the lights have to be on, or the more of the 24 hours they would have to be on.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. The only concern I have is that we're lighting, and I appreciate the directional, but if we're lighting up things that aren't having any activity, granted it may be intermittent, from my aspect, we're supposed to be considering energy savings here at the Capitol and in our own private lives, that I would strongly suggest that if our legislative intent is to have energy savings as a priority, that we also included in this bill to say if there is no activity that they are allowed to turn them off so that we can save on our electric bills.
Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, committee members, very quickly, we do cite in the bill that the lighting may be direct wired from a carrier facility power source.
Mr. Qualley, can you direct us to the page?
Oh, I'm sorry. page 2 at line 2.4. We do list some options without reading the entire piece here about ambient battery storage source, have another constant energy source, and designed with fixtures of electrical circuits, power saving and ambient atmosphere actuating switches is in the bill.
Madam Chair,
Senator Osmond.
Which is all well and good, but nothing around here ever says permanent, and this is our legislative intent, like saying it in the bill and in the legislation and in the statute, that we expect that if there is no activity, that you turn the lights off. So I still think that that's something that would be significant, and I know Senator Dibble would consider it a very strong addition to this bill, that you would indicate that they should turn off the lights when there's nothing going on.
Senator Crossan.
Madam Chair and Senator Gosmick, that's an excellent idea, and I'd like to mandate that, but I guess one of the problems is that it is a mandate of a private company. I would think that they would, if they are interested in making sure that they can provide the best cost of their services, they would turn the lights off.
Well, Madam Chair, we mandate a lot on private companies, so I don't have any qualms about saying turn the lights off when there's nothing going on. But with that, I won't continue the debate, but I think that it makes it a stronger bill if you did.
Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, committee members, I am reminded of when my children were younger in those years that we told our kids to turn the lights off. But I just want to add one piece that is beneficial here, is that by wiring the yards and having a circuit there, railroad security is an issue. And there are products on the market by having electricity at these yards that we now have perimeter devices that can go from end of yard to other end of yard because we have electricity there that can also help keep the yards secure. It's an additional benefit as well that's not in the bill. We simply bring it to your attention, the benefits of having yards electrified. So in terms of any arguments about lights on, lights off, and railroad security of freight in yards, we would anticipate that this discussion on Senator Osment's questions, and bottom line is it's a much safer yard and secure yard with electricity because of the perimeter equipment that's available to the railroads today, and which has been common vendor in products that are available to the railroad industry since at least 2006, 2007, invisible perimeter detection devices that need electrical power. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Members, any other questions or comments? Additional testifiers for this bill?
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is David Brown. I'm with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, a division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. I'm the State Legislative Board Chairman. I'm also Region 3 National Legislative Chairman for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. I stand in support of the passage of this bill. This issue of lighting has been brought forward throughout my entire career of 43 years. They have improved lighting issues, sometimes not on a yearly basis, but they certainly have improved from when I hired out. The railroads are making record profits right now, and there should be no reason why we are working in the dark. It's time to address this lighting issue. On Senate File 2290, as the good faith effort has been kicked back and forth, and the lighting has been being lit up the yards at a snail's pace. The safety of the workforce is entitled to the safest workplace to move America's freight. It is time for the rail industry to come out of the dark ages, and I strongly support your passage of Senate File 2290.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Additional testifiers? Please come forward. Senator Carlson.
Yep. Madam Chair and Senator Osmick, I do want to draw your attention to subdivision. Section 1, let's just say line, all of a sudden I've missed it here, 2.7, it's electrical circuits that include power saving or ambient atmospheric actuating switches. And the lead-in says that it, in line 1.21, it does say that they must be. If you'd, I would be certain. certainly like to work with you if you have any language that you'd like to put in there stronger. I'm certainly willing to talk to you about it.
Senator Carlson, if I may, just real quickly, Council has pointed out that line 2.7 refers to point E and 2.3, so it doesn't go back to the one on the first page, just to be precise.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. Permitted and not, though not required.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd love for Ms. Brzozowski to throw out an amendment on this for to say that the power saving devices will include something to the effect of when there is no activity within the vicinity of the train yard that the lights go off. So I'll let her come up with that. It's nothing terribly difficult or heavy handed.
While Council works on that, maybe we can proceed with some testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Welcome. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill. We believe that the bill has very vague terms. It is overbroad. It's very costly. And at least one provision of this bill we believe is unconstitutional. In terms of vagueness, first, there is no definition of the term switching. We've heard references to classification yards, and we've heard references to 2 and 3 track yards. Classification yard is typically a larger facility that has multiple tracks where individual cars are switched, put together to form blocks of cars that are then pulled around and assembled into trains. It's a much busier activity, a much busier site, a lot more activity, a lot more cars moving around. There are other locations, as was mentioned, 2 or 3 tracks where you might just be dropping off a block of 25, 26 cars or something. You drop off some cars and you leave. You don't have the complexity of operations that you have in a classification yard. So you don't have the same demands for lighting that you would have in a busier place like a classification yard. Another term that is vague is the triggering term, switching 5 times a week. Is that 1 week out of 52? Is it all 52 weeks? How many weeks? Is it a couple of weeks when you have peak activity during harvest season, for example? All of a sudden you have to install lighting in a location that otherwise wouldn't call for it. Costly, we would be putting up 100-foot-tall light towers. Those cost about $100,000 a piece. It would cost my company alone several million dollars. On a quick check, we think several million dollars to comply with this bill. The dark sky provision, it requires that the light be focused down. I can tell you from experience that we have installed light towers where the light was focused down. Light meter readings showed no effect on the adjacent neighborhoods or nearby neighborhoods, and yet we were besieged with complaints because people could see the light. It was to them a source of pollution. It interfered with their view of the night, and they were upset about it. And I'm pretty sure that when we put up towers almost any place, you can assume that there will be some people who will not be happy. The light may not be shining directly into their windows, but when they look out their windows, they will see it, and that will be a problem. We have heard references to several times to record railroad profits, but there was also a reference to record low injuries. The rate at which personal injuries in the rail industry occur have been reduced by about 80% in the past 30 years. That it is lower than most industries. It is lower than average. It is lower than the injury rate for state and local government, in fact. We were told that other states have lighting statutes. I'm unaware of any state that has anything resembling what is before you. A couple of other states do have statutes dealing with placing lights on switches in yards and with a number of exclusions for those. One is Missouri. It's an 8-line statute titled Lights to be Placed on Certain Switches, When, by Whom, as opposed to this, which is titled Railroad Yard Lighting. I'm unaware of any state that requires lighting several thousand feet of track in order to inspect trains. This would very definitely be a unique statute in the country. There's a question, why is it just Class 1 and 2 railroads? Why is it just any railroad? Why isn't it other industries such as mining, logging, that have their own switching operations? What about truck terminals where there is a lot of activity at night? There is no mandate that I'm aware of for those. So why is it just a couple classes of railroads? Finally, the provision, I understand it has been removed in the Senate with the solar energy that we believe does have a problem with the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, to answer that question. So in a to recap, it's vague, it's unique, very costly, overbroad, and we think unnecessary given the safety record of the rail industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Questions, members? Senator Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, I'm sorry, did you mention the number of poles? That was a question. I'm not sure if you were in here when I asked that question earlier of Mr. Qualley. I was trying to get a sense for, like, how many poles a month would have to be installed in a somewhere in a it's basically a 30-month period starting as of July 1st, 14, and whether that's really even accomplishable in terms of the workforce that you have now. Did you actually give us a number of poles that I missed there?
Yes, sir. Chair, Representative, no, I didn't give a number. We did a quick check. We haven't had a time to do a thorough evaluation. We are estimating, though, between 90 and 100 poles at $100,000 apiece just for BNSF Railway.
Thank you.
And we would probably have to contract that work out.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so
Chair.
Senator Sengen.
Mr. Meeks, maybe you can... I've never really been sure what a railroad yard is, but I guess there's definitions here about what needs to happen. But I'm thinking of even a lot of small towns in southern Minnesota that maybe have a couple of tracks, and perhaps you, as you suggested, that you know during harvest season, why there's a little activity there, and the rest of the year they're pretty abandoned, really. But it would seem like if we ever assembled or disassembled even one or two cars, that would be a railroad car, switching yard, so to speak, and this would apply, even in perhaps a very small town that doesn't see a lot of rail activity except kind of incidentally once in a while. Would you interpret it that way?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, yes. There is no definition in the bill for what a rail yard is. A rail yard is basically some number of tracks where certain tasks are performed, such as setting out and picking up cars.
Chair? Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
I think we've gone a little bit far afield here when you ask about what a rail yard is. There's a count of them that we did provide here.
Okay.
And these are rail yards where a specific activity goes on. And the issue is having lighting sufficient to do inspections. Each car has to be inspected at 14 points. And then the conductor who is responsible for that has to sign off on those cars. So there's a specific action that goes on here. We're not trying to light a large yard so that everyone can see and read or anything like that. This is to light the areas of inspection. And tall poles, are not desired. We do say in here, I see 30-foot poles, but it needs to be focused where these inspections are taking place. And I guess another item I want to mention, Mr. Chair, is that we're not talking about injuries. We're talking about inspections going on. The injury rate, that's very laudable, but that isn't what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the inspection of the cars, the safety of the cars, and there's more business going on, especially with tank cars now. And everyone knows that, for instance, even the North Star road is being clogged with extra trains that are going through there. So there's a lot more business going on. And back to
Let's see, I guess Senator Peterson's comment, there are four companies involved. So there's, it's not that it's one railroad company. There's four companies involved, and they have different size yards that they have, that they would be lighting. And I don't know about lighting 1,000 feet of track anywhere, because this is only those areas where the inspections and the assembly of cars goes on.
Right, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Senjum. Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
All right, go, Senator Senjum. Go ahead.
Not wanting to belabor it, but you know, the more I kind of think about, you know, we've got situations in probably all over Minnesota. You know, the local grain elevator has a sort of a side spur, and yeah, I mean, you know, they're sort of, you know, they fill their car with grain and they come and hook it up to another train at some point in some fashion. Not a lot of activity, but some. We've got a couple of situations or side spurs in Rochester where maybe there's one car a week, perhaps, but nonetheless, they're taking that car apart. They're putting it together back with the regular train at some point, hauling it off. I suppose to some extent it's a switchyard, but the activity there is so minimal. But it would seem so definitionally that would continue to apply to this bill. I mean, I can understand what I see out here in St. Paul and or whatever, and, you know, pretty large, massive operation. But some of these little side spur things with where you connect and reconnect or disconnect rather way. It I don't know. Just something to think about.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Senjum, yes, there's a waiver for the small yards that's available.
Okay.
All they need to do is apply for that. And when we're talking about that single car or the small number of cars at an elevator or somewhere where they're pulling the cars to a larger switchyard, though there's not the time pressure, and perhaps even there's daylight to do those inspections. We're talking about inspections in the dark. That's, you have to keep that in mind.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. I have Senator Jensen and then Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Senjum, I can't help thinking about my dad when we're having this conversation. He was a cooperative elevator manager for over 50 years for Harvest States. And he would require the lights in wherever it was where people are working and inspecting, especially when they're inspecting something that other people rely on the safety of that. So I just felt like I needed to say something about that we're not just talking about cost of a light. This goes to safety, and there are these in other areas. For some reason, it hasn't moved beyond that, and it seems like it's going to take some legislative action to move from that conversation to get to where we need to be, where these lights are available for those people that are inspecting those cars to make sure that there isn't some kind of an accident that would happen for that company and that railroad. So I would really urge people to support this bill.
Senator Peterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Sweeney. I'm not sure what your title is, but to your knowledge, has UTU ever brought this issue up in regards to their union negotiations? And I'm trying to get a sense for how important or what priority it was for them. And when the testimony is done, I'll ask Mr. Qualley the same thing, but has it ever been brought up in their union negotiations?
Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in contract negotiations themselves, I really don't know. I know that, yes, there have been many discussions where this issue has been raised by the unions with the railroads. But in the contract negotiations themselves, I don't know that it's come up or how it was addressed.
And Senator Peterson, this has been a legislative initiative previously as well.
Okay, thank you.
Unsuccessful so far. Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Senator Osmick has the A2 amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is the Osmick Green Thumb Amendment.
All right.
It's to something that we talked about while you weren't in the room. This is to add in a clause that specifically indicates that when there is no activity, you turn the lights off. We don't need to pay for electricity. We don't need to build new nuclear power plants. We need to turn the lights off when we're not using them.
So, Senator Osmick, you're going to get a mark in your favor from the Sierra Club. And I'm going to get one.
Mr. Chair, I might have to reconsider here. But I am conservative at
heart. But we're trading because, you know, I've got the cut down all the cattails in Loring Pond, so I'm going to get a nick on my Sierra Club rating. So.
Well, you're bullying those.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, the only concern I'd have on this is that we're looking at the inspection lights now and that this does not carry over to what the railroad might consider security lights. Would you agree to that?
Mr. Chair, I think this specifically is in the section that talked about the railroad inspection switching area because it's under it's under line 1.15 under the provisions of the railroad lights over switches and inspection areas. So it's very specific to just the inspection lights. If they want to light up the whole yard like a Christmas tree and pay for that electricity, I guess okay. But this is specific to the conformity. When you're not using the inspection lights, turn the inspection lights off.
Okay. Mr. Chair, great. Excellent. I just wanted to get your intent on that.
All right. Great. Any other questions on the A2? Senator Osmick moves the A2 amendment. Oh, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if Senator Osmick would be open to have the language be more permissive instead of just saying that only at times when the activity is taking place but may be displayed. So if it's practicable, I mean, some operations might want them on the entire time because it's more efficient or easier to deal with versus having to have them on and off. So this would be permissive. So maybe adding may be displayed. Then you won't get the star with the Sierra Club.
Well, that would help me and get
only get
away
half
from
a
that
star.
Problem.
Only half.
It doesn't matter to me. I would be willing. Where would you like to put the May?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, I think it would be right in the beginning of 1.3. May be displayed only at times. Would that work? Or
no. Ms.
Probably not.
Says
council.
No.
Okay.
Does not work.
You're stuck open.
Don't want to have her to say that.
It would have to be a separate, like a G after 2.9 to make it a pencil sentence.
Mr. Berezovsky would have an alternative approach. In the meantime, Senator Kiffmeyer, did you want to get a question in?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that if you want to see an example of this, come to our yard, our house, mm-hmm. and you'll see the yard light turn on and turn off very nicely and has done so for the last 34 years. And so it's not even a new technology since we have it at our house. Secondly, if you want something a little bit newer, you can go to the basement of the state office building parking ramp where the lights go on, matter of fact, sequentially as you walk down the aisle looking for your car. So I do not think that this is anything whatsoever that would be difficult for our own United States railroad companies to handle with this legislation be just fine. Just my opinion.
With the Senator Kiffmeyer, the motion detector technology you're referring to. Motion detector technology when folks are around, I see. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
That this
just
allow.
For the sake of expediency and also that I'm sure that the author will talk with Senator Franzen, and I don't care if they put May in, but for now, let's put it in now, and they can deal with it at the next stop.
That would be fine. Mr. Chair, that would be fine.
Yeah. So take the amendment as is. I'm sorry, is that the suggestion?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right.
It's fine.
All right, sorry. All right, so on the A2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Carlson.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, all we need to do is go up about 15 feet, and the lights on the displays are motion activated also.
Okay.
So as I leave the Capitol at night, the lights come on.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to belabor this. I just think of, you know, unintended consequences maybe. But going to maybe line 3-6, Senator Carlson, where it talks about the waiver, and it talks about the railroad common carrier being able to make that request. Maybe I'll just preface my real question by, would there be any situations where a private business might have to, because they had a side spur or maybe two spurs or something like that, be a rail yard and somebody other than a common carrier? Would this apply to anybody ever that's not a carrier but may have tracks on their property?
Mr. Chair, Senator St. John,
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Qualley just gave me a note that said that there's, and where is that scene? It says private industry is exempt.
Okay. Then I don't need to ask the second question.
All right. Thank you. All right. So, members, Mr. Appitz, you haven't had a chance to testify.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, the other railroads that are here in Minnesota beyond the Burlington, Northern Santa Fe. I'm not going to do my preliminary remarks. I'm going to be brief. I do want to go to a question that Senator Kiffmeyer asked, because I did a little survey that may be helpful to this question. I want to call into question the numbers that we're talking about here, and I think that's what Senator Kiffmeyer was talking about. I was fortunate to receive a list on Friday of the 53 yards that we're talking about and the 27 yards that apparently are not lit. And I sent it out to the four railroads that are identified as having these yards, and I said, well, tell me about the yards. What do you got? Are these lit or not? I can tell you what the Canadian National responded back on the 11 yards that they have, and I'll give you some sense of, then we'll see what we're dealing with here. These are in northern Minnesota, northeastern Minnesota, essentially, up in the range, et cetera. We're talking about the yards in Proctor, Rainier, Virginia, and Keewatin, and all of those yards are lit. They're identified as lit, and they are lit. Talking about six other yards that CN has that were on this particular list that we're talking about here, one in Two Harbors, one in Mesabi Junction, Bowabic, Allen Junction, Wales, and Wilpon. And so we said, what's going on in those particular yards? With regard to the yard in Two Harbors, there are pole lights in that particular yard. It's not unlit. There are pole lights in that particular yard, and there's been no complaints about those pole lights. Mesabi Junction is a yard where there is no switching going on, so it's not lit because we don't need lights there. If there were a need for lights, there would be lights there. In Bowabic, there's pole lighting, but it's not an active switching yard. They store freight and cars there. Allen Junction, there's no active switching that goes on in Allen Junction, so there's no lights there in particular. Wales, by design, trains operate there only during the daytime, not at night, and so there's no lights there. And Wilpon, that operates only in the daytime as well. So I think we're talking about a rather limited number of yards here, and the reason that most of these yards aren't lit is because there isn't operations at night. Let me go also to Senator Osmek's question about additional lighting. I'm not sure what the amendment that you've added just did. I will reference the fact that Mr. Qualley said there are security issues that raise the reason for us having these lights there, and I'd suggest that security is a very, very serious concern for us, both in terms of hazardous materials that we move and in terms of the quantities and value of the materials that are moved. We don't have railroad police that are certified here in the state of Minnesota, and we have fought that battle several times over. We have not won that battle. I think this is simply going to complicate the issue of whether or not that material is secure. But I'll tell you, if anybody wants to know what lighting and neighbors put together do, then talk to the mayor of Rainier, where we have a yard. CN has a yard, and for years the debate went on with regard to what happens with the light shining in that particular neighbor's bedroom. Depending on your sleeping habits, lit rail yards, as apparently are going to be required here, can increase light pollution or annoyance, however you might want to look at it. One of the things that Mr. Qualley did indicate is there is a process for this. We do go through a safety process of reviewing these issues, debating, figuring out these issues, and lighting where lighting is necessary, where our workers are placed in a situation where they need lights. It's not like we turn the lights out and send the workers out into the rail yard and ask them to inspect trains. That's not what goes on. Safety is our primary concern, and we have a process that works. We have a situation here where I'm not sure how many rail yards we're talking about, and we're just asking you to let this process work and please reject this bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Abbott's members? Senator Kaffir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have questions specific to Mr. Abbott's, but I do appreciate the statistics and the facts and the going out and getting that more detailed information was something I was wondering about. And so that's very, very helpful and seems very reasonable as well. I think one other thing in this bill, though, that still concerns me, though, is that the commissioner's authority here, because our conversation here has been very focused on the yards themselves, switching, inspection, maintenance, repair, et cetera, and so forth. However, this bill also has language in it where it says, adjacent to a portion of track performing such activities. And in that situation, when it is adjacent, the commissioner has authority, quite broad authority, to order activities, construction, and so on. And this is when it would be adjacent. And so maybe either Mr. Apitz or the author, or Mr. Sweeney, could address that section, but it's certainly a concern for me because I thought this bill was more about just the specific yards themselves. This looks like a hugely way broader situation with tremendous authority given to the commissioner. It's page 2, line 18.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it does extend it beyond, you know, certainly this is a much broader statute than anything else that's out there. It does give the authority, apparently, for the commissioner to order it in, you know, not just little discrete areas, but in much longer stretches of track.
Well, Mr. Chair, it not only concerns me about that, it's just a straightforward power and authority without any opportunity for process here. There's no matter of fact, they can order it and they might appeal, but the order is still there. So it's a very oppositional kind of a process. I see Mr. Qualley looks like he wants to say something and I would rather wait until.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much. Philip Qualley again on the record. It is certainly not our intent to be adversarial. No, the MnDOT commissioner, and MnDOT is in the room, has had authority from the Freight Rail Office and has had jurisdiction on the walkway language that is now in statute since 2008. We have not seen any broad, sweeping requests. We have not seen any broad, sweeping mandates. We have not seen an adversarial process or any agendas to go beyond what the scope of the bill in this case suggests. We are looking at the AREMA standard, which is defined in lumens. We're also looking at a minimum of one light pole for two switches, which is clearly prescribed. And, yes, this bill is specific. This bill is actually very specific. We respectfully disagree with BNSF, and this is not overly broad. We are being very prescriptive that the lighting is to go with the track at the switches. So I hope that's helpful in answering your question. But the commissioner has authority under the areas of 218 and 041, and we've seen no intent in this bill or in past history that the MnDOT commissioner has acted unilaterally or broadly with any railroad areas. I hope that answers your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's well said. I appreciate that, but that is not what the law says.
Mr. Chair, Senator, 112, or the portion starting on 111, talks about lighting adjacent to those portions of railroad yard tracks where railroad common carrier employees frequently work on the ground performing switching, inspection, and repair activities. That can be a stretch of several thousand feet where employees do that work. The same in the commissioner's authority, where it is adjacent to a portion of track performing switching, inspection, maintenance, repair, or fueling activities. That can be a very long stretch of track. It is not limited to an area right by a switch. The statute in Missouri is limited to the area by a switch. This is much broader.
All right, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this didn't say repair activities, can somebody describe the repair activities that you're talking about in that language you just cited? Is that on the car or on the track? Or do you make you made it sound like if you're repairing the track or something, because if you're doing repair work, you would need lighting. I'm sure you have lighting at every place that you're doing that that's available.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I assume it refers to repairs on the car. Person doing a car inspection will drive a vehicle alongside a train and do an inspection, replace brake shoes, for example, do minor repairs on a car.
In the dark?
They have lighting.
I'm sorry, Mr.
And when you talk about doing inspection, a person walking the train, checking the air brake system.
Mr. Chair, so then if they have lighting, this shouldn't concern that area.
Mr. Chair, Senator, they have either overhead lighting, as in many of the yards, or else they have lanterns with high candle power.
Mr. Qualley.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to comment. I think Mr. Sweeney just made our point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right.
Yeah. Gestures don't get captured on the audio tape. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I do want to add there's you know, the whole sentence that was read about switching, inspection, maintenance, repair, or fueling activities are exposed to hazard resulting from the lack of lighting.
Mm-hmm.
So it defines when lighting is appropriate. If you're exposed to hazard because of the lack of lighting.
Okay.
So that's when lighting is important.
All right. Members are going to call for additional testimony. We need to get this to a vote. We have a couple more bills to hear. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill, Senate File 2290? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, it seems like there's quite a bit of work to be done on this bill. Would it make sense to table it and let the party continue to work on it?
Senator Pratt, tabling it would kill it because we need to meet a policy deadline. It is going to finance, and so there's opportunity. It's not going to the floor. It's going to finance, so there's opportunity to continue to work on it, and I agree with you, there is more work to be done, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt certainly could make that motion if that's what your feeling is. From my perspective, members, we've heard very compelling arguments here on both sides, and I would encourage you to vote against it for a number of reasons. Employers in Minnesota kind of have two silos of expenses. They have fixed expenses, and they have variable expenses, and of course what we do here in this building is create fixed expenses for employers like this lighting, which we heard testimony is going to be in the millions of dollars. And when employers spend those dollars on fixed expenses, guess what? They may not be able to spend as much on variable expenses as they would hoped. And every single organization, doesn't matter if it's for-profit or nonprofit, their single biggest variable expense is wages and benefits. And so, members, when we increase these fixed expenses for employers, it takes away their ability to raise variable expenses or to pay more wages and benefits. And if we look what we've done in this building just in the last 12 to 24 months with health care and telecom and warehouse and repair taxes, adding on things like the cost of energy with our new energy mandates for solar and wind, members, we are drastically raising the fixed expenses for employers in Minnesota. And I would urge you to vote against this bill because that's what this is. That's what this is doing.
All right. We need a motion, Senator Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do want to answer a little bit of that. The fixed
Carlson,
expenses.
We need to move this along. We need to get a couple of people into the room here, and we need two more bills. So,
okay.
You know,
very briefly,
there's going to be more. Testimony on this bill because you're going to be working on it some more. Yes,
okay,
please respond.
I would ask that if anyone has some information that they would like to discuss it with me.
All right. Thank you. You had a final comment. I know Senator Senjum wanted to return, so you can make your comment while Senator Senjum is on his way back.
Yes. What I'd like to do is I'd like to make sure that we mention that the objective here is to have safe railroads, is also to inspect these cars under the best circumstances possible. This is not an option to have safe railroads. We need to have safe railroads. And if you look, I believe on the handout that has the UTU on the front, it shows those 14 points that have to be inspected. And this person that is responsible for that is signing off that these cars have been inspected and that they are safe to continue on. They don't get looked at again sometimes for thousands of miles because they're part of a train. And so it is a very important task that these people handle, and they're handling it under very inopportune circumstances.
All right. Thank you.
Do we have Mr. or Senator Senjum
come? He's presenting a bill on 123. I don't know if he's stuck at the table presenting right now or not.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Peterson.
This bill is going to finance next.
Yes.
Members, the only thing I'd comment, you know, Senator Cohen, I serve on finance, and Senator Cohen has been fairly disciplined in keeping the conversation to costs. I see Senator Rest nodding her head, and that means the fiscal note. So, members, if you have concerns about this bill in policy areas, this is the place to deal with it. It's not in finance. So please don't let anybody in here tell you that this bill is going to get fixed from a policy standpoint as it moves forward, because I don't think Senator Cohen's going to allow that to happen.
Senator Peterson, it'll be referred back down to division.
Right.
So we'll have it in front of us again. Senator Rest.
It will come back. It's very unlikely that Senator Cohen would send the bill to the floor from the full Finance Committee. He will send it back to the Transportation Finance Division. And so there is an opportunity to continue to review the policy issues before it goes back to full finance, where the stricter standard should definitely follow, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson. It's such a strange setup we have here that we can't meet as both a policy and a finance committee at the same time. But since we're waiting, I can just...
Oh, actually, we just got permission to go ahead and vote.
Huh?
So.
He said
it was
okay.
Thank you for
but
your
anyway,
efforts.
in the past, the finance divisions and the policy committees have been separated, and in the name of efficiency, we put them together. But they still operate separately. So where's the efficiency? You know, I don't know.
So, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ress, I agree 100%. But I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, that we are going to have this back in front of this committee for certain. I agree with the concept of the bill. Obviously, I think we can all agree that there still needs to be some work done on it. When it comes back in front of us, can we continue that work so we can meet the deadline and still have it back there? Okay.
Yep, absolutely, Senator Miller. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm still left puzzling how a light 30 feet in the air is going to accomplish some of these things. While I appreciate it's more ambient light, but I'll tell you what, if I'm inspecting, I want a torch, and I want it looking right at the spot I'm looking at. And I'm not quite, but, you know, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Qualley, we can chat, but I know the chairman wants to move on, and I agree that since it's coming back, we'll work on it from there.
Right. So So Senator Carlson moves Senate File 2290 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
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 Motion carries. Thank you. What's next? So Senator Carlson. Oh, 2516.
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
We did share them already.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Right. Senator Carlson, 2516.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have Senate File 2516, which makes some changes to clarify some disability parking issues, one of them being for legal wards. This allows the guardian of a permanently physically disabled legal ward to receive a disability license plate for motor vehicle, motorcycle, one-ton pickup truck, or self-propelled recreational vehicle. The vehicle bearing the plates today must be owned and primarily operated by the guardian, and that's under current law. These plates are available for vehicles owned and operated by permanently physical disabled people or custodial parents. So Section 2 allows a guardian of a permanently physically disabled legal ward to operate a vehicle with disability plates without penalty, provided that the guardian is using the vehicle to transport the legal ward. And Section 3 modifies some requirements regarding disability parking signs. And if you recall, we have a universal description of disabled parking has the blue stripes. And what's happening is some people are not paying close attention to keeping those blue stripes clear. And that's the area for people with the devices on their cars to load and unload. So what we're asking for is if you have the symbol, and if there is a sign there, the access sign in white and blue should also state that violators are subject to a fine of $200 if they don't center their vehicle on the sign. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Margo Mdecky Cross here from the Minnesota Council on Disability to help explain the bill.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Mdecross.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. These are two small amendments, and again, one goes to expanding the definition of who can use disability license plates, and there are many individuals who prefer disability plates over certificates only because they can't be stolen as easily. They're not going to fly out the window when you're driving down the road, and they're they stay with the vehicle, and folks want that security. So this does expand that definition to the custodial parent of a legal ward. We were finding that many severely disabled people who live at home, once they reached the age of majority, they had to quit using plates. Their families needed to stop using those plates, and they just simply said, why? And so we said, well, we'll go and see if we can get that fixed. Mm-hmm. So that's the first amendment. The second amendment goes to 169.346. Right now, the signs that you'll see designating disability parking requires that that there be the international symbol of access, which is the little blue guy in the wheelchair, that it indicate that the maximum fine is $200, and that it restate that vehicle ID is required. We want to put one more little message in there, and that is please center your vehicle on sign. And what we're finding is now that the disability parking spaces are a tad bigger, people are using the striped areas as additional parking space. And so when somebody comes along who uses a van or a vehicle that has a side loading lift or ramp, we can't use those striped areas any longer because somebody else has parked their vehicle partially on it. And so we just simply want to remind people to be courteous. We want to remind people to center their vehicle on the sign, and we're hoping that will eliminate a lot of the sloppy parking that we're starting to see.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Reinert, then Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that last point, that's not the same as if you'd parked in the handicap spot illegally?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. If you're parking in the striped area, you're parking in a no parking area. That is not intended to be parking space.
Correct.
That is only intended to be shared access, a shared access aisle, which means that if you need extra space to get out of your vehicle, you have it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you. I guess the point of my question was I've always just thought of that as a handicap, part of the handicap space, and would never think of parking there. What I'm getting from your testimony is that that's not how it's treated. So the significant ticket that goes with illegally parking in a handicap spot is not applicable.
Senator Reiner, what I think we're talking about are folks who have the right to park in a disability spot who are crowding out the loading and unloading space themselves. So here's a disability spot, here's another disability spot, and there's the unloading, kind of the shared space in between, and this person is kind of creeped over in this parking kind of right. In that space.
Okay.
She's going
after her own hair. Is what
I'm saying. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
So, Thank you.
All right. Senator Kiffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that clarifies things. I was hearing that, and maybe in the marking they might want to add something in the future to that, or like they do and can do to help usage be correct. I appreciate that. Cindy Gercross, the disability, Minnesota State Council on Disabilities, I just want to confirm for the record, is in full support of this language as a group, as an organization, correct?
Oh. Ms. Imdick-Cross.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if this Section 3 actually makes us have to replace all the signs, it sounds like it does, that are currently in existence, and if there's a fiscal note to that, just to know what we're voting on. And it seems to me, it seems it's more of an enforcement issue, because the law should be clear. It's just people are not following the law. So if we can have some assistance, I suppose, with law enforcement to help not only inform but enforce the law, when they see that, that would be helpful. But just wondering about the fiscal note and whether law enforcement is or department transportation is on board with it too.
Okay.
Ms. Imdick-Cross.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I actually didn't know that there was a fiscal note. Designated disability parking signs have a lifespan of 7 to 10 years, and we were assuming that they would simply, as they were replaced, they would be updated. We had no intention of forcing people to go out and replace the current ones. So I just testified on this bill in the House, and there was no fiscal note at that point that I knew of.
There isn't one.
Okay. So just for the record, our intent is that when the lifespan of the sign expires, that they will be replaced with what the current requirements are.
And Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen, one of the things we did talk about, I talked with Ms. Cross here, is the enforcement. And I described to her, and we're going to be talking about a little bit more, that my police chief made it very clear to me that anyone who sees someone parking illegally can get a citizen's arrest or citizen's a ticket form,
really?
And fill that out. And the police chief assured me that the police offices will send a ticket to that person's back. So that is something. And Ms. Cross said that she was going to make sure that that gets publicized. So there isn't enough necessity to call a cop.
Senator Pearson, this is our opportunity to get ours towed.
Yes,
Senator.
Yes.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we're going back to Ms. Brzozowski again here.
All right.
The way this is written in page 2, starting on 2.32, I don't see anything that says that we have the option to replace the signs as needed. Everything I read here says, and to Senator Franson's point, yep, you're going to do this, and you're going to do it right now. I think we probably need to have some level of an amendment saying, or to this saying, that we allow for purposes of this subdivision or something to that effect, that we allow the normal replacement to happen and not require an immediate change. I'll leave it up to her to wordsmith it for amendment number 2 from Senator Osmond today.
All right.
And I see you shaking your head, Mr. Chair. I think you agree that nothing says permanence like having it in statutory language.
Correct. I think, I think we agree at this side of the semicircle that allowing signs to be replaced over time as they wear out is a desirable amendment to have. And I see a pen flying across a piece of paper to my right here, so we'll have something in just a moment. So, any jokes? Anyone have any jokes?
No. Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Senators, that was our intent, and I was looking for it. I thought we did have it in the language, and it is missing. So we do want to, we should say something about it as they're released.
Great. All right. Brzozowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, my suggestion would be an effective date with an application clause following Section 3. So it would be after 3.10, and it would say effective date. Section 3 is effective on August 1, 2014, and applies to signs that are replaced in the ordinary course following the effective date. And then I don't know if you want to add, but that they have to be replaced as of a certain time or date or year.
Sounds good to me, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't add an effective date. I just let them, they'll replace them as needed. It's the new statutory language. I don't think it's needed. But I'll take the rest of it.
So, Ms. Brzozowski, can you please reread, and then we'll take the vote.
Yes, Mr. Chair. After 3.10, insert, effective date. Section 3 is effective on August 1, 2014, and applies to signs that as they are replaced in the ordinary course following the effective date.
Small.
I think that has your ear. All right.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, could we say all new signs, because they're constantly putting in more disability parking spaces and new lots, so new signs and signs that are being replaced.
Right.
It's probably the intent of the language, yes. But I'm sorry if I stepped out of my...
Right. That makes sense. So it applies to new signs and signs as they're replaced in their normal course. All right. Does everyone understand the amendment? All in favor of the Osmond Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion. All right. Are you ready to vote, members? Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Senator Carlson, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move Senate file...
2516.
Senate file 2516 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
As amended and forwarded to
the floor.
The floor.
All right. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you. Senator Kent.
Sure.
Thank you.
Going to get you in under the wire.
Give me some credit.
Hey,
no.
Once I read it, yeah, there's nothing in here. It's not going to do it. So.
It's good to have.
Nothing says presidency like having.
No, okay. I might feel a bit confused.
No, this is at the tent right now.
Oh, okay. Yep.
That's it.
Senator Kent, Senate File 2424.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 2424, a Department of Public Service agency bill which addresses several issues for driver and vehicle services. These issues involve driver permits and some federal conformity-related measures. First, Section 1 addresses permits for motorized bicycles, more commonly known as mopeds. This section would streamline the permit process, eliminating the current expiration of the one-year motorized bicycle operator's moped permit and allowing for a moped operator permit that is valid until age 21. Section 2 addresses the commercial learner permit fee by allowing Department of Vehicle Service, Drivers and Vehicle Services to charge for a commercial learner's permit. This change is driven by a new federal requirement for tamper-proof commercial learner's permits. DVS asks to charge $2.50 for a commercial learner's permit to cover the cost associated with issuing this new tamper-proof permit. Finally, Section 3 applies to commercial driver's licenses and conforms to federal law. This provision allows DPS to conform to federal laws related to commercial driver's licenses and operation of commercial motor vehicles so that the department is able to implement federal commercial driver's license regulations, which are required of commercial drivers since they travel throughout all United States jurisdictions. This provision clarifies that federal laws take precedence over state regulations with issues regarding to record keeping and license holder disqualifications. You will see in your packet that there is a fiscal note, but as is the practice of driver and vehicle services, the revenue generated by the fees are structured to cover the expenses of the services they provide. So you'll see that reflected in the fiscal note that it's basically a wash. Here with me today is Pat McCormick, the director of the Driver and Vehicle Services, who will provide more information about the bill and help answer any questions.
Welcome, Ms. McCormick. Before you begin, I have to tell you, I just heard from Mr. Gordon, our previous committee administrator, who says that I need to convey my compliments to you publicly. He just took his driver's test at the California Division of Motor Vehicles and said it was a fright. That the office was run in a very inefficient manner, the test was administered in a very inefficient manner, and that we need to be very, very proud of the services that we provide here in Minnesota. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't hear comments like that very often. So that's one I'm taking back to the staff.
I know we like to chew on you a lot, but it's all a matter of context and reference. Ms. McCormick, were you going to testify or respond to questions?
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Kent did a good job of summarizing the bill, but I'd be glad to take any questions that the members have.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? All right. Senator Westrom.
Chair, I think I have an amendment for this bill.
All right.
Whenever you're ready for them.
All right. We're ready now.
Okay. Am I right, Craig? Is this the right bill? It's the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure. I think this is the bill that I had it drafted for.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, not a surprise. This is similar language that passed last year out of our committee dealing with the speed limit increase in Minnesota. Passed the House of Representatives, and only in conference committee did we have a little trouble. And so just urge members to support what we passed last year. This would go 55 to 60 on our rural roads where it's appropriate. And it would work with MnDOT, giving them about 11 years in the normal replacement of signs to change those signs so there wouldn't be a fiscal cost or a new fiscal impact to their agency, and they can work it out over that long period of time.
All right, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum. While I appreciate the efforts here, our concern is that we have some time pressing matters here in terms of federal conformity, and we are concerned that this might interfere with the ability to pass these. And so I would respectfully ask members to not support this amendment.
Senator Westrum, I do know I've urged MnDOT to take a hard look at this subject. I know they've come up with an idea, a proposal for you. I don't know if they've had the chance to approach you on that or not.
Not any specific proposal, Mr. Chair. I know we talked a little the other day, but I don't have any sort of knowledge of a plan that's going to affect. I will just update you. You, I believe, are aware of it, but if they don't happen to be, Commissioner Zelli did take a good look and raise the speed limit on two roads from Canada to the Iowa border, western Minnesota, Highway 5975, last fall, upon Senator Bach's urging and myself and others. I like the step direction they went with that. It's just there's a lot of other roads that are still at 55, and I think there's pretty widespread support in the Senate bipartisanly and as evidenced last year in the House. And Senator Kent, I'm happy to work on this bill as we get to the floor, and if we have another vehicle that we can split this apart and that apart, I'm happy to work with you on that mission. I just know that bills need to be vehicles at times, and I don't want to thwart the efforts, and I'm happy to work with you to see where we can find, assuming this language could pass here, we'll find other places to help keep it moving along.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, I appreciate that, and I would be willing to work with you on this in another context. We are concerned, again, about time sensitivity. This was referred to another policy committee in the House, and so we do need to make deadline.
All right. Well, there is no germaneness rule for amendments in committee, although this is clearly not germane to the subject, but Senator Westrum has the right to offer it. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, if we added changing the speed limit on 35E, would that make you more inclined to actually accept this amendment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, actually, no.
Well, I do think, this puts the passage of this bill ultimately at some significant risk, and we do have to deal with the CDLs and federal conformity, but members can make their own decisions. I know how people feel about this issue. But Senator Westrum, there is a pretty good proposal that MnDOT has developed, and I'll direct them to approach you with that conversation.
Say that last part again, Mr.
Chair. I said I'll make sure that MnDOT approaches you with, they beyond what they've already done, which I think was a fairly significant step that they took. So I think they're disappointed that you're still pushing this issue, but nevertheless, they've come up with a policy proposal to inventory all the roads and determine whether or not they're appropriate for increasing the speed limit. And they need to have that conversation with you directly, and I'll make sure they do that.
Right.
Members, I would encourage you to resist this amendment. But let's take a vote. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion passes. All right, Senator Kent. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? All right, Senator Kent, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 2424 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance.
All right. All in favor of Senator Kent's motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right, members, we are adjourned.